I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to I Like to Movie Movie. My name is Dan Scully. I am flying solo today. I'm also doing something a little bit different, a little bit new this time around. I'm live streaming across both of my Instagrams. I've got Movie Movie Cast in front of me. I've got Philly Window Zoo to the side because Philly Window Zoo has more followers. And so if I can combine you all into the Movie Movie Cast, that would be absolutely fantastic. But right now I'm recording my Best of the Fest episode from the Philadelphia Film Festival. Just ended last week. It was a really awesome time. So shout out to the Philadelphia Film Society. Thank you so much for granting me press access to the festival. I saw a lot of great stuff. For the first time, I went to the opening and closing night parties, which was very, very cool. Got to hang out with a lot of friends. It's just a great week of movie watching overall. Saw a lot of really, really, really cool things. And so I just wanted to go over some of my favorite stuff. Apologies to all of the fans of the show for the late release on this episode. That is just due to the fact that film festivals are marathons, not sprints. And so, yeah, you kind of get spun doing that because I saw like 25 movies. That's 25 different stories that you have to think about in a critical sense. And it gets to the point like here's a great example. Every day when I go to the gym, I usually watch a television show while I'm on the elliptical machine. But because I could not fathom inserting more stories into my brain, over the past week, I watched almost the entirety of the original Jackass series, simply because that was the best way to distract myself from the fact that I hate working out, without shoving more stories into my brain. But if you want to see my coverage of the film festival, you should check out scullyvision.com. And there are a whole bunch of capsule reviews. There will still be some more coming over the next few days. Also want to shout out Gary Kramer and Andy Elijah for contributing to the site over the course of the festival. It was very nice to have some extra hands down there because, as many of you probably know, it is exhausting to pump out that much material. So without further ado, we're going to go through the program. I have two cameras on me. It's so fun. I feel like a news guy because I can like do this and then go to camera B over here and then go to camera A over here. But let's see. We're going to go through the schedule and I'm going to go through some of my more favorite stuff. I mean, one of the best things that I saw was actually the second time I saw the movie. You've heard me talk about it ad nauseum on this show, as well as in the stuff that I've written, but Late Night with the Devil was, it's just excellent. And it just today, it just got announced that Shudder picked it up, so you will be able to see it on your own dime rather than waiting for festivals like I did. But I saw that earlier this year at Overlook Film Fest. It was the best thing that I saw there, and it was one of the best things that I saw at the Philadelphia Film Festival. It's got David 101 Dastmalchians as a grieving widower who is hosting a failing late night show, and they do like a exorcism live on air. It's found footage style, and things get out of hand as they do in movies, but you definitely want to check that out when you get a chance. But let's go through, man, I don't even remember what I saw. I'm going through the program and my list of what I saw is in my phone, and my phone is currently recording me. I did not plan this well, but that's just what happens. My life is pandemonium, all right? You're just going to have to deal with that fact. One of the best things that I saw is something that is getting a wide release very soon. It's called American Fiction. It is Cord Jefferson's feature film debut, and it is about an author played by Jeffrey Wright who is struggling to sell a new novel. What he sees as novels that pander to white audiences are what's popular, and it's simply something that he does not want to do. But after some personal issues cause his life to become that much more expensive, he decides, almost as an act of protest, to prankishly write a novel that fits the bill, essentially just writing about black trauma for white audiences. And wouldn't you know it, the novel is a hit. It's a very, very thoughtful movie. It's one that's also very funny. That does not sound to be the case when I describe a movie as I've just described it, but it is a very, very funny movie. And Cord Jefferson was there, and he did a very thoughtful Q&A afterwards that just made me like the movie even more. But Jeffrey Wright, I mean, he's a GOAT, all-timer, one of the best actors who has ever done it. And seeing him flex both his dramatic skills and his comedic skills all at once is really a joy. Sterling K. Brown has an incredible performance as his sort of absentee brother, who is newly out of the closet and thus living it up. And he's very, very funny, but there's a strong emotional anchor to it as well. And I think that's what gives the movie so much strength, is that it is very, very emotional and dramatic at points, and then boom, it'll hit you with something funny. But it won't undercut the drama of the moment, nor does it ever allow the drama to become so heavy that it undercuts the comedy. So it pays proper weight to basically every modality of the story, and it does it in a way that's super entertaining. This should be coming out in a few weeks, but yes, American Fiction, you do not want to miss that one. All right, what else do we got? Oh, I gotta shout it out. I've already posted a review about it, but another thing that's getting wide release is Dream Scenario. Dream Scenario is the, it's somewhere between Bo is Afraid, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and Being John Malkovich. It is a story of a very low-key guy, does not want fame, played by Nicolas Cage. And one day he just starts showing up in people's dreams. People who have never seen him before don't know who he is. And they start showing up in his. He starts showing up in their dreams, and his life spins out of control as a result. And the director writer Christopher Borgli. I know I fucked that up, but Christopher Borgli. He did a movie that was at last year's festival called Sick of Myself, and Sick of Myself. It was about a woman who disfigures herself just for, like, social media attention. So it's very obvious that that's something that is on the mind of this filmmaker. But what differs from Sick of Myself to Dream Scenario is that in Dream Scenario, it is not something that our protagonist wants. He is thrust into the spotlight against his own will, and as I said, things get out of hand as a result. It's a really great role for Nicolas Cage. As I understand it, the original idea was to actually have Ari Aster direct it. He ended up just producing, and he allowed the screenwriter, Borgli, to also direct it, and I think it was a smart move. When Aster was attached to direct, he had envisioned it with Adam Sandler as the lead, which I can see, but I think that it probably works better with Nicolas Cage because it allows him to do what it is that he does that we all know him for. But in a different way, it's not Nick Cage going big. Like, yes, this is a Nick Cage movie, if you will, but he actually plays a more realistic character. He's not going big, despite it being a project that allows him to play to his strengths in a very big way. It is a very subdued performance, but when we see inside some of these dreams and Nick Cage gets to appear in them, it really starts to make sense why he's the guy for the job. This is a movie that's not for everybody. I imagine it will upset some people. I imagine it'll just be off-putting to some people because it's just so fucking weird. But it's exactly my kind of movie. It's the kind of thing that really speaks to me. And I think it's very thoughtful. I think that it's very strange. And I think that it has interesting stuff to say, and if all of that fails, it's just so funny. It's so funny. Nick Cage delivers a well-placed fart, and it's in a moment that is not, like, this isn't a fart joke movie, but it might have the best fart joke that I've ever seen in a movie. So definitely want to check out Dream Scenario. That comes out in a few weeks, as does Saltburn. Saltburn is the sophomore film from Emerald Fennell, I don't know how it's pronounced. She won the Oscar for her screenplay for Promising Young Woman, which is an excellent movie. But now that she has an Oscar, it seems that with her second movie, she gets to kind of go a little further. And Promising Young Woman was a movie that was designed to push buttons, and it pushed them very well. And this one is designed to push buttons even further. a lot of times when you have a sophomore filmmaker who has basically earned themselves a blank check by the success of their first film, their second one often falls victim to the freedom of that excess. I love watching it happen, but it's a very special thing when a sophomore film leans into that excess, but does so in a way that makes it, it's still cohesive and holds together. And Saltburn is very much that. It's a crazy story. It's got Barry, I don't know how to say his last name, Keoghan. I don't know how to say his last name, but as I said in my review, I could probably draw you his dick from memory now on account of how much I've seen it in this movie. But Barry Keoghan plays this guy, Oliver, I believe is his name. Oliver Quick, who is going to Oxford University for the first time. He is not your typical Oxford stock, meaning he don't got the cash. But all the people that he goes to school with are very hoity-toity rich people, including his new friend, Felix. And Felix, played by Jacob Elordi, also don't know how to pronounce that last name, but he's like the new hunk out of Australia. But he's a great actor. And he takes a liking to Oliver and invites him to the Saltburn Estate. That's the title of the movie, to spend the holiday season. And what goes down at the Saltburn Estate is as thrilling as it is skeevy, as it is insanely horny, and as random acts of violence start piling up. And yeah, I don't want to spoil too much because this is the kind of movie that you got to go in pretty blind to, but it is just a sumptuous feast of visuals. The lighting is phenomenal. It's very clear that Emerald Fennell she's operating at an insanely high level. The lighting is to die for. Her direction is so inventive and so on point. And this script is that much better than Promising Young Woman, which is already just an excellent script. Really liked everything about it. And it has Richard E. Grant. And Richard E. Grant gets to deliver a signature, "How dare you!" Which, you know, you gotta have if you have him in a movie. And he delivers a really great one. Rosamund Pike in a supporting performance. Carey Mulligan in a supporting performance. Saltburn is a win. There is one scene in Saltburn. I won't say what happens. You will know it when you see it. You will know it when you see it. That it had the entire theater losing their damn minds. It was... I want to spoil it for you, but I absolutely can't. But so often when people go, "Oh, there's a scene in this movie, you'll know it when you see it." You might not know it when you see it. You will know it when you see it. Both cameras. You will both know it when you see it. It is insane. Saltburn is not one that you want to miss. So one of my favorites was a film called Monster. And I want to make sure that I have this director's name correct. Fuck it. I don't know. But Monster is... man, I really fucked myself over by using both my iPad and my iPhone because I didn't write down any of the filmmakers' names and I can't look them up because I'm live streaming. But what are you going to do? You're going to look up Monster. This is a story that sort of riffs on the Rashomon idea, where it's showing a situation from multiple angles. It starts with a little boy who in school is being bullied by a teacher. And so his mom is understandably upset by this, and we see the entirety of the story from the point of view of the mom. Then in Act Two, we get to see that same story from the point of view of the teacher. And it opens things up a little bit, changes our perspective a little bit. And then in the third act, we see it from the point of view of the children in his class. And the way that this is arranged isn't... I mean, I use Rashomon as a loose connection, because whereas Rashomon shows you from, like, different angles, this one sort of, like, pulls the lens back on the situation concentrically. So, yes, whereas we have a different surrogate in each lens and we see it from their point of view, we're also given more information about the situation from each of these different vantage points. There are different audio cues that let you know what is going on when. There are certain visual cues that let you know what's going on when. And it's as thrilling a story as it is touching. The child performances are fantastic. Lots of movies live and die by that. And it's a bad child performance can sink a movie. And this is chock full of fantastic child performances. And another one that the less you know going in, the better. But it's the kind of movie that I didn't even know the general plot of it going in. And it was just consistently surprising, consistently thoughtful, and just like very well done. It seems to be a pretty like basically directed. It's very straightforward, at least in the way it's shot. But in terms of how it's constructed, is almost revolutionary. Really interesting stuff. I had a discussion with a friend about the ending. He saw some ambiguity in it that I did not see, but I think that speaks to just how dense of a script that this is. Because when we were making our points, again, I really don't want to spoil. Both of our angles on this could be defended, and defended based on certain things that are in the text of the movie. So really no right or wrong answers there. It just comes down to perspective. How appropriate. That is essentially what the movie is about. But yeah, it's one that has little bits of humor. It's a very humanist movie in the way that it's just trying to be open-minded about everybody's experience there. And it lands in a place that I just think speaks to the idea that communication is key. And we really seeing this from all of these different angles, you end up having a very empathetic view of this story. And unfortunately, without picking any sides, there aren't any clear answers to this. But the truth that is found by the kids in the center of the story is pretty profound, very moving, and I thought ultimately rather sweet. And it's wild to come out of a movie that's called Monster feeling that way. But definitely, definitely one that I hope gets a release. I would imagine this is going to pop up on like Mubi or Criterion, but it's something that is very worth checking out if you do. And that actually leads me, if we're talking about kids' performances, I'll just tell you straight up, my favorite film of the fest was a Utah-based, we'll call it an adventure, called Riddle of Fire. And Riddle of Fire is, now if you listen to my other show, Hot Property, you'll hear the full story. But on my way to Riddle of Fire, I did get randomly attacked by a man on the streets and had to pepper spray him. It was absolutely fucking horrifying, but I went to that theater, charged up, freaked out, and just really unsettled. It takes a very special kind of movie to bring you down from that and cast a spell over you, and Riddle of Fire did exactly that, and then some. So, yeah, that's the highest praise that I can offer it, but Riddle of Fire is a story of a bunch of kids. There's three of them that, and the one kid is subtitled simply because he talks like a little kid and he mumbles and he, but it's very cute. You could probably understand what he's saying just by listening to him, but the subtitles drive home the comedy. And these three kids steal a video game system from like a big box store and they go home to play it, and their mother is sick in bed. And they're like, "Mom, you gotta let us play this new game system." And she's like, "No, you're gonna sit in front of the TV all day. I know you guys. That's all you'll do." And they're like, "Come on, just 4 hours. Come on, just 3 hours. Come on, just 2 hours." And the mom agrees and says, "Okay, 2 hours, you can play the game. But first, you gotta go outside and you have to retrieve a blueberry pie for me." And that's the inciting incident. These kids have to retrieve a blueberry pie and bring it to their sick mother so that she will give them permission to play video games. That's the plot of the movie. But what follows is an adventure where the kids cannot get this blueberry pie. They're armed with paintball guns, mopeds, and little just like cranky little kid attitudes, and they go out into the forests and mountains and towns of Utah to try and get this blueberry pie. They run across a group of, I guess the term is witches. They run across a crotchety baker. It's essentially a road movie, but that road is the woods of Utah. It's very funny. It's very cleverly done, like nonstop laughs, but it's also very touching, very moving, very heartwarming. And like I said, if you happen to be almost mugged on the streets on the way to the theater, it will calm you down, as it did for me. But it is a perfect film, I think. And it's very cool to see a film that was shot in Utah. That's not something that you often see. I don't know if Utah has like a film credit the way that Georgia does, the way that Philly is working to do. And but it was beautiful. I mean, Utah's a beautiful place. And for a backwoods adventure, it is the perfect setting for a film like Riddle of Fire. If there are any movies at this fest that I will be buying a Blu-ray of if they become available, Riddle of Fire is one of them. Yes, I am gesturing wildly with an Apple Pen to let the people watching the streams know how strongly I feel about Riddle of Fire. Let's look through the program and see what else we've got. I have more people watching on the my personal Instagram than on my movie Instagram, but I'm committed to the movie one just because it's of the proper branding. Meanwhile, the people that are just listening to the recording of this, they fucking hate me, but what are you gonna do? Let's see, what do we got here? Yeah, you know, I'll get into it. I watched, as the final film of the festival, a film that you can actually watch right now on Netflix, and you should. It's called Sly. Yes, it is a documentary about the life and times of one Sylvester Stallone. You see, back in the 80s, Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger had a bit of a rivalry. It was a friendly rivalry, but, you know, if Schwarzenegger had this many abs, then Stallone had to have this many abs. If Stallone one-hand operated a gun, Schwarzenegger had to use a bigger gun and do the same thing. It was stupid machismo bullshit, and I love every second of it. And it seems it's not over, because Schwarzenegger self-produced a Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary for Netflix called Arnold. And it's essentially just a three-hour commercial for the product that is Arnold Schwarzenegger. But if you are on the hook for that product, which I am, it's very entertaining. So naturally, Stallone had to follow up with his own Netflix-based documentary about himself, which is ultimately a commercial for Stallone, whatever he may be at this moment. As a Stallone superfan, I was completely into this documentary, but also a little bit disappointed by it because it doesn't really go that deep. It's very smart in the way it relates what he's going through in his life at a certain time and how that affected the scripts for specifically the Rocky movies and the Rambo movies. He talks about what he was going through at the time and how that informed it, but mostly what he was going through in terms of career. The one thing we don't really get into is family stuff. Like, there's literally one part where he starts talking like, you know, you gotta live on through your kids. You know, you have a kid, and, you know, you start to see your life a little bit different because you see it through the eyes of your little ones. And as he's going through this stupid bullshit, within the montage of the film, images of the dearly departed Sage Stallone start popping up. But then he doesn't say a goddamn word about Sage Stallone. He doesn't even say his name. You just get a picture of Sage Stallone, 1976 to 2012. And that's it. And then it's back off to the races of, yeah, when I was making Rocky III, it was all about, you know, trying to get Mr. T in the thing and having some fun. And so it does not go deep. I wish it went deeper. I feel like there is a darkness there. Like, he touches upon his father being abusive, as does Frank Stallone, whose own documentary, Stallone, Frank, that is, was at last year's Philadelphia Film Festival. My God. I spend way too much time thinking about the Stallone family, but what are you going to do? And you can even see, if you're on the video, it's hard to see. I have a Stallone poster behind me. But I just wish that it went deeper, because it is interesting, and there is some very thoughtful stuff in terms of how he sees himself as a writer. But, like, even the framing device is a little bit clueless, because he's talking about how he wants to reset his life by moving across country. He's going to sell his giant house and he's going to move. And while they're packing stuff, he's seeing all of these things from his past, all of these memories re-triggered. But when I say while he's packing stuff, I mean while the movers he has hired are packing stuff for him. And there's a lot of footage of, like, the movers doing work and just, like, Stallone, who looks like a literal monster. is just sitting there like, hey, you know, I found this tape of this interview I did back in the 80s. And then you listen to the interview that's like, you know, I gotta make another sequel to this. And it's just, but as like our meathead laureate, he does have some wisdom to spout about life, about his career. And there's a lot of really great, just old footage that, you know, the kind of stuff that you can't find online because it only exists in a tangible format, in film reels, in literal cassette tapes. So, again, it's a shallow documentary, but it's one that is quite interesting and very worth checking out. It's the perfect thing for Netflix. Maybe not the best for the big screen treatment, simply because he does look so horrifyingly monstrous. And to see every crag on his face, it's wild. But, you know, and like Tarantino's a talking head, which is, you know, pretty interesting. Schwarzenegger is a talking head, which is comical, to say the least. But I definitely recommend Sly. The second to last film that I saw was also one of my favorites of the fest. It is a film called The Promised Land, starring Mads Mikkelsen. And I'll say it right now. No love lost to Brian Cox. No love lost to Sir Anthony Hopkins, but Mads Mikkelsen is the best Hannibal Lecter that we've ever had. I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. He is the best Hannibal Lecter that we have ever had. In The Promised Land, which is a Dutch production, so he is not speaking English in this movie. Is Dutch a language? I don't know. Is he speaking Dutch? Is that what it is? And he plays a, this is like, I guess, I want to say the 1840s? 1830s, 1840s, something like that. I don't remember. But he plays a, he's going out into this land called the Heath, which is a land that, according to all of the land barons in the area, cannot be farmed. But he believes that it can be farmed. So he's taking his soldier's pension, he's buying this land, and he's going to farm it in the name of the king, and he's going to turn this land fertile yet again. There's a lot of historical context that I don't have, but I think that the film gets through in its actions. It communicates them well. You know, there are roving bands of people who you're legally not allowed to employ, but because he's a good guy, he employs them. But what really is happening here, because there's a lot of text to the movie. It feels like a really good long novel, but And believe it or not, it's directed by the guy who directed the kind of shitty adaptation of The Dark Tower that we got a few years back, which, to be fair, is a pretty movie. It's just a misfire in terms of adaptation. Fingers crossed Mike Flanagan gets his wish and can adapt it long form. But I digress. The Promised Land, essentially what it boils down to is a bitch boy land baron who's like a real asshole wants the land that Mads Mikkelsen is farming. And he's not willing to give it up. And so a very cruel battle of an asshole have versus a curmudgeonly but, a virtuous have not occurs over this land. And it's very thrilling. It is surprisingly brutal at points and always shocking when it happens because it happens unexpectedly when it does. But it ends up being a very... It's like a very thematically resonant tale in terms of the family dynamic. It's very effective in paying lip service to the brutality of you know, just you go 200 years ago, things were, you know, we still have awful things happening now. 200 years ago, you know, if you were of an oppressed class, it was really bad. And you know, the divide between the haves and have-nots was such a wide gulf. And so something like unfarmable farmland is ultimately of value. And they use that to tell a strong story about this family that he sort of constructs over the time, while also fueling this back and forth battle of wills between him and, as many of my friends have been calling him, the bitch boy baron. But there's nothing as satisfying in a movie as having a villain who is just dripping with evil. And this villain is the worst. Oh my god, I hate him so much. He's like Joaquin Phoenix in Gladiator bad, where like if I saw this actor on the street, I would dislike him just because he did such a good job playing this bitch boy. But it's just a phenomenal movie, and it was one that I didn't initially have on my festival schedule. And I just kind of fell into it because the time slot opened up, and by the end was blown away. Like, not only was it better than I expected, but it was one of the best movies that I saw at the festival, as well as really this whole year. So keep your eyes open for The Promised Land. I imagine it will get a wide release. If it does, I will post, I'll update the show notes to reflect that. Let's do a couple more. We can talk about a couple more small things. Man, that's the thing about film festivals, is that your head just becomes mush. I got nothing left. I've got nothing left. But I shall continue nonetheless. So we did The Riddle of Fire. Again, that is probably the best thing I saw at the fest. Riddle of Fire, Promised Land, those are like top tier stuff. And of course, Late Night with the Devil, as I mentioned. Oh, here's an interesting one. So a very interesting movie called The Sweet East. I did not know what to expect going into this, but I kind of thought it was just going to be like a slow burn drama, a little coming of age tale. But actually, it's like a John Waters would be proud sort of a punk rock anarchic sort of thing. And it's about this young woman who, while on a class trip in Washington, D.C., a shooter breaks into the club they're all hanging at, played by Andy Milonakis, remember him? And he demands to see the basement devoted to child trafficking that he knows is in the basement of this club. So, you know, it's we're making fun of the those like QAnon losers. And but because he breaks in with a gun, everybody scatters, and our hero, this young woman, finds a tunnel in the back and exits out the back with a punk rock kid who is played by Nick Cave's son, I recently learned. And she just kind of from there starts bouncing from group to group, traveling up and down the East Coast, and just kind of surviving by her wits and just kind of not worried about getting home. It's a road movie. It is a hangout movie. She hangs out with a character played by Simon Rex of Red Rocket and Scary Movie 3 and 4 fame. He plays a white supremacist that she gets involved in. A white supremacist with a heart of gold and a brain of shit. But they play it for a lot of humor. She runs into a terrorist organization who she hangs out with for a little bit. Some trust fund punk rockers that she hangs out with for a bit. And she is sort of she's kind of dumb. Let's not say dumb. She's undereducated. And she just plays someone who's just kind of rolling with the punches, seeing what happens. And because she's a young woman, she ends up getting a lot of favors done for her in exchange for her sort of kind of being flirty. But she works this and knows it and uses it to just kind of go up and down the East Coast, the Sweet East, as it's called, getting into trouble and, interacting with troubling populations of people. But again, it is very, I wouldn't say it's very John Waters, because it's not like trying to be trash, but it's the kind of like anarchic glee that his films have. This has, you know, there's a random musical number, but it's the kind of thing that, again, I went in just like, oh yeah, coming of age tale, this will be nice. And then 20 minutes into the movie, I'm gobsmacked at just how much bodily fluids I've seen, how purely insane the whole thing is. But the central performance is fantastic. It's one that, this is another one that I really hope gets a release, because this is the kind of movie that not only would I like to watch, I would like to watch someone else watch it. So I want to show it to other people. The Sweet East, very, very worth checking out. We'll talk about one more. What should we do? Bravo Burkina, that was good. Saltburn was good, we talked about that. I know what we'll talk about. One of the most scariest movies that I saw at the festival was called Red Rooms. For those that don't know, a red room in the world of internet lore is a digital room that you can log into to watch torture, rape, and murder. It's something that ostensibly exists on the dark web. that people auction off access to so that the sick and perverted amongst us can watch something truly revolting. Red Rooms is the story of a young woman who works as a model and a online poker player, but who moonlights as a true crime obsessive, specifically in the form of a recently arrested, currently on trial, child murderer. She camps out in front of the courthouse every day to watch the events inside the courthouse. What's being explored here is the current true crime boom and the ethical considerations of making entertainment out of tragedy. And as a pretty big true crime fan, that's something that you always try to remember, because admittedly, true crime is the kind of thing that we like because it is sordid. I can't even really describe to you why I feel so attracted to true crime, but it's a bittersweet feeling because we are listening to the stories of actual people who have undergone unimaginable and oftentimes permanent and tragic circumstances being repackaged and repurposed for, you know, just what I listen to while I'm walking around. And that is fucked up. I mean, there's no two ways about it. It's fucked up. There's ways to do it, I think, responsibly. Shout out to Crime Junkie. I think they do a great job of keeping it victim-centric and also taking their success and putting it towards the charity of helping out with this sort of thing. But, you know, at the end of the day, as much as I say that, I also will get, like, upset if the episode I'm listening to isn't violent enough. So this is something that's very much on my mind and Red Room speaks to. But what's cool about Red Rooms is as this woman interacts with the guy on trial, not the guy on trial, but with the situation that's on trial more and more, it starts to blur the line between fandom, obsession, and complicity. And again, I don't want to spoil because this is a movie filled with plenty of surprises, but it's a movie that maintains for feature length, like an unsettling gut feeling. It's one of those movies that when it ends, you go, ooh, I'm not okay. You know, like the way Hellraiser leaves you feeling. And but it's very low key. There's nothing very big or bombastic that happens. There is one segment that couples just a slight head turn by a character with a really bombastic score drop that gave me like chills, like actual chills. A shudder went down my spine and it left me feeling upset for much of the night. And it was just, it wasn't even because of the content of it. It was just in the filmic construction of it, which is really phenomenal. But even so, you know, ever since it ended, it's one of the movies from the fest that I've been thinking about quite a bit. And it's just a very thrilling movie. It's quietly thrilling. It's quietly effective. It's very fucked up. But just like a sturdy thriller with great performances. And it's French-Canadian, so it's actually in two languages. It jumps between English and French fluidly, so you have to kind of dip in and out of subtitles. But I kind of like stuff like that, though. I enjoy that because I mostly live a monolingual life. And so seeing people speaking in multiple languages fluidly is sort of aspirational. I got to brush up on my Duolingo, got to get back on Spanish. When I was working in a situation where I was conversing with a lot of Spanish-speaking folk, my Spanish was actually great. But now, muy mal. I was at Más o Menos for a little bit, but now, muy mal. But I digress. Red Rooms is really fantastic and like deeply upsetting stuff, but in the best of ways. I could not recommend Red Rooms enough for you. I'm losing my voice because this is my second podcast that I've recorded today, so I don't want to say too much and lose my ability to work at my job tomorrow. We'll do one more. The Delinquents. The Delinquents is what's referred to as slow cinema. Some of you might be familiar with the concept of slow TV. The most popular example of slow TV is Painting with Bob Ross. Very relaxing stuff, very low key. You're not there to get involved with the plot. You're just there to watch the process of it all. Slow cinema will have plot, will have story, but rather than making the film as lean as possible and boiling it down to just story, slow cinema will often have, you know, like, if somebody's driving somewhere, a standard movie would just say, okay, hop in the car, and then cut, boom, we're at the next location. Slow cinema will have them getting into the car. We'll have them starting the car. We'll have them driving for a while. It's patient with that kind of stuff. Not for everybody, but when it works, it works. I went into The Delinquents. I was told that it was a slow cinema heist movie. Knowing that it was 3 hours long, I got myself ready. I steeled myself thinking this is going to be rough. I'm going to have to think about peeing. I'm going to have to wonder how long it's going to be. But lo and behold, about 10 minutes into the movie, the spell it cast over me was complete. I did not feel the length at all. I did not get up to pee even once. I was locked in. And so The Delinquents tells the story of a bank worker who one day goes into the vault and takes a bunch of money and walks out. Why? Because he did the math, and the amount of money that he has is equivalent to what he will get by the time he retires. But why wait 25 years for retirement when you can just stash the money, serve your 3.5 year jail sentence, and then come out and live the retired life from an earlier time? So that's what he does. And as soon as he steals it, he goes to his friend and says, hey, hold on to this for 3.5 years. I'll talk to you then and I'll split it with you. How's that? And so what follows is our lead guy in jail dealing with what it is to be in jail, our money holder out of jail dealing with what it is to hold on to some money, and then in sort of the third hour, a love triangle sort of develops. So it's not really a heist movie, considering the heist, as it were, takes place within the first 20 minutes of the film, and then the rest is just hanging out with these people over that 3.5 year period until he can get his money together. Very funny stuff. Very, very funny, but only funny in that way that, like, you're not laughing out loud, you know, nobody's fucking a pie or anything like that. This is just, why did I reference American Pie? It's just 30 years old. You know, it's not your standard comedy. It's more about how awkward things can be, or how uncomfortable things can be, or just how weird humans are. We're weird creatures. We do weird shit. And it just kind of milks that for 3 hours, but absolutely hypnotic. Again, not for everybody. There were a few walkouts in the theater, but for the people who it is for, it will work wonders. I spoke with a few people after the screening, and everybody who was on the same page as me, they didn't just like it, they loved it. And so if you're the type of person who thinks you could be into that sort of thing, you will want to check out The Delinquents, because, you know, and if you're not into it, turn it off. No harm, no foul. But if you're into it, it is quite the adventure to go on. And it's also just beautifully shot. So highly recommend. I'm running out of my voice, so once again, thank you to all the listeners for putting up with the delay here. Apologies for the delay. Everything will be back on schedule this Sunday. There will be a new episode of Hot Property at Hot Property Pod. As always, you can follow this show at Movie Movie Cast on all of the things. Thank you to everybody who listened on both of my, or watched live on both of my live streams here. And once again, a very big thank you to the Philadelphia Film Society for putting together another great festival. Again, shout out to Andy, shout out to Gary. Really appreciated you picking up the pieces and adding some content to my page, scullyvision.com. And also, like, shout out to the friends that I made. You know, hello to Bobby. Hello to Trish. Hello to Izzy. Hello to all the allied people. It was great hanging out with y'all throughout the entirety of the fest. And yo, Kev, one of my best friends, he showed up just to hang. So shout out to Kev as well. But yep, thank you once again. We'll be back on regular schedule. Next week's episode is the completion of our Halloween episode arc. I've got Steven watching Doctor Sleep, the director's cut. So if you would like to join us for that, please, please, please give that movie a watch. If you haven't seen it, you are going to love it. And yeah, then listen to us, not this Sunday, but the following Sunday, where we will be talking about Dr. Sleep. So, yeah, we're gonna turn Steve into a horror movie fanatic if it's the last thing that I do. I did it with the last host. We'll do it again with this host. But also, shout out Garrett. What up, brother? That's it. That's been Movie Movie. Peace, y'all.